Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I will be your host this morning. The music I'm playing is called Raja'in, or We Will Return, a song about hope and resistance in Gaza by 25 Middle East artists. Today, Jan Hawkins speaks with Jose Padin, professor of sociology at Portland State University, about what protest tactics might work best to grow the pro-Palestinian movement. The remainder of our show this morning will be devoted to a recording of a press conference that laid out the risks of the critical energy infrastructure hub in Northwest Portland and what must be done to prevent a disaster of epic proportions in the event of an earthquake. Only on KBOO will you hear in depth about issues like the local student demands to promote peace in the Middle East or Portland activist efforts to forestall disaster at the CEI hub. We're now in our spring membership drive. If you can, consider donating to your alternative community radio station today. You can donate by texting KBOO to 44321 or clicking on the red donate button on your KBOO app. Or you can go to bit.ly/KBOO. You can also send a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. Students at Portland State University are among the thousands of campus activists across the country mobilizing against U.S. complicity in Israel's war on Gaza. On April 29, Students United for Palestinian Rights held a teach-in at PSU in opposition to PSU's close ties to Boeing, a major military defense supplier for Israel. Professor of Sociology Jose Padin spoke at the teach-in about the importance of careful and reflective tactics to build a strong social movement. Jan Hawken asked Padin to expand on these points in light of the occupation of the PSU library by other groups over subsequent days.
This is Jan Hawken, and I'm talking today with Jose Padin, a Puerto Rican teacher and scholar and faculty member in the sociology department at Portland State University. Padin is also a member of Portland Workers' Rights Board and a member of PSU faculty and staff for Justice in Palestine. Well, Jose, welcome to KBOO and the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Hi, Jan. Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, I'd like to start with the teach-in at PSU on April 29th, organized by PSU's chapter of SUPER, Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights, and a number of PSU faculty members with PSU Faculty and Staff for Justice in Palestine also participated. In your talk, you emphasized the importance of thinking through tactics in social movements, in particular in terms of their inclusiveness and the way that action should communicate something of the meaning or aims of the movement. What were you trying to convey to student activists?
A little bit of reflection around tactics and a little bit of reflection around the importance of communicating what you're doing. The whole issue of tactics is obviously a different matter depending on whether you belong to the part with more or less power. If you're working to stop the mass killing, the ethnic cleansing, the occupation of Palestine, you're clearly the party with by far the least power. So one of your aims is going to have to be to build people power. I mean, let's just put it bluntly. U.S. interest in the Middle East, U.S. imperialism, the State of Israel, and here we are on a campus or in a city street. So in the US, it is people power to stop the military funding and arming of Israel, for example. So to build people power, you need to bring more people into the movement, not fewer, more. So your tactics can be divided into those that bring more people into the movement or those that reduce the support for your cause. That's what I mean by inclusiveness when I use that term. I mean, to grow the movement, which involves bringing new people in, and there's a long, long way to go here, those people need to understand what your aims are and why they are desirable, urgent, just, etc. That seems elementary, but it is often neglected. And if you don't explain those things clearly, others will explain them for you, and chances are it will be your opponent who explains those things. We don't explain our aims clearly, then your aims can be explained as just you want to create trouble, or you can be accused of things such as anti-Semitism, for example, or being anti-American. We need to explain ourselves. You need to explain yourself with coherence, with clarity, and persuasively. And that applies both to explaining the aims and explaining methods. Now, coherence is more complicated than it would seem, but I think it's really important to break it down. I think there's three types of coherence that our stories need to have. One is logical coherence, just cause effect, okay? Especially pertinent in relation to the methods or tactics we use. In other words, what you are doing connects in a reasonable way with this other outcome. The second one is ethical coherence. And a third one, not to be minimized, because we're trying to connect with people to grow a movement that are outside our circle, is common sense coherence. We need to understand what the common sense of people is and how it works to speak to that as well.
Yeah, there's also, I don't know how this principle would fit with what you've outlined, but there's a long tradition of prefigurative politics in the left where the relationships you form, the ways you come together and confront forces far more powerful than you and your group need to reflect something of the society you anticipate. So the role of nonviolence, the role of a democratic process for decision making, forms of nurture and care that are part of coming together in a protest to action. So is it, would you include that idea of prefigurative politics, the relationships that form or build through a movement and organizing?
Yeah, that's really important. What you're describing as prefigurative politics is what I have in mind when I just say ethical coherence. So when I evaluate my methods, can I, in a common sense way, communicate to people at large that aren't part of the movement that not only what we're aiming to accomplish, but how we're doing it actually prefigures kind of the type of relationships we want to have? I think that naturally, if they don't, if our methods don't seem appealing from that standpoint, okay, we're tripping ourselves over. We're getting in our ways where it is just tactically mistaken. If I just people won't trust that you either have the intentions you say you have or that you're the right person to follow to get there.
So I'd like to present the dilemma that unfolded that very day around what you're describing. I was there at the teach-in in part as a KBOO press participant, and it was one of the most thoughtful, inspiring teach-ins in memory for me, and I've been to many over the decades. The level of participation, there was one aggressive heckler that one of the organizers kind of kept him engaged on the side, and a group of activists kind of encircled the speakers. They didn't shove him out or push him out, but they kind of sidelined him to keep the focus on why they were there. Later that day and evening, there was an occupation of the library, and cameras were everywhere. And then, of course, that became the dominating news story that unfolded over the week versus the important organizing and thoughtful actions that were less dramatic in earlier months of these campaigns on campus. So how do we deal with that as a movement? And this may take us into the different kinds of tactics and actions around the country, including the encampments that have been very organized and disciplined, but the press tends to descend on these places along with the police when there's visible action and not as much speaking.
Well, first of all, the point of direct action is that it be action and that it be visible as well if we're aiming to grow a movement, and we have to. I mean, when we look at the numbers, there's been an uptick over the last decade in general support for Palestinians, but it's still relatively low, very low in the United States. So, in order to move the needle politically, we need to grow the numbers substantially. So, our actions need to be public, not only direct, they need to be visible. All of that is important. Now, I have a sense that you want to examine or compare different types of direct and visible action.
Well, I think there's always a risk, including the occupation of the library, that is unlikely to stir sympathies by many in the community, including people in the Palestinian rights movement. The teach-in ended very publicly before the occupation took place. There were different groups, I think, vying for space on the park blocks, but you run the risk of course, separating the good protesters who are well behaved and law abiding from the so-called bad protesters in judging certain tactics that involve property damage, question of what is the role of violence, who decides or determines if an action is violent, what is the meaning of occupying a library? I mean, is that a particular place that communicates something? How would you interpret the occupation of the library as an observer?
I mean, there's many levels to that, but the first thing that I think responsible direct action that communicates, that aims to communicate to a larger public and draw them in, needs to be responsible. And that means to me, it needs to take into account the impact it has on others. In particular, those other people who are either on your side or potentially on your side, and does that action hurt them in any way? Without bringing in yet the whole issue of property damage, just the occupation of a facility may have a negative impact on others. A library, for example, did you think it through? Did you take into account how it would impact them? I think those are important considerations.
Yeah, and I
That's
think the decision, and we don't know, and I think I would not want to speculate, and I assume you would not either, how the decision was made among activists, how many were involved in that decision to occupy the library. But I know that an important practice in left and feminist organizing, in my experience, is having a group that makes both a decision where you establish relationships of trust, whether you decide who's willing to get arrested if that's a decision, and who is at too much risk to put themselves in the position of getting arrested, how jail support is set up if that is a potential outcome, how to communicate what you're doing, which I think was very much part of an action where a group of activists got arrested in January. There was quite a bit of effort to communicate what they had done and how they had made that decision.
I have commonly heard the following justification around property destruction in a movement. And it says, lives can't be recovered, property can always be rebuilt. And that is absolutely true statement of fact. Now, I find it fairly irrelevant when it comes to deciding on whether or not a tactic is advisable. I
You're
don't
getting
think
to
it.
that idea of coherence and what one thing has to do with another.
Yeah, I don't think that's a coherent story when it comes to deciding on a tactic. And the reason is it is not logically coherent and it violates common sense. For a movement in the United States trying to stop the brutality of the Israeli action against Palestinians, there are only two examples I can think of that make property damage justifiable in a coherent way. One is the property that you're damaging in any material, actual material way protecting Palestinian people? It's hard to think of any instance of that here. If you have a way to disable or destroy an Israeli tank that is going to run over a Palestinian village, that is absolutely justifiable, I think. Okay.
Well, this doesn't involve property damage, but there's been a long-standing campaign organized by Super to cut for PSU to cut ties with Boeing. And I think out of the escalating actions and organizing, including the teach-in and students confronting the Board of Trustees at PSU, the president has offered to look again at that and is having a forum at Portland State looking at the arguments, which I think are very compelling for cutting ties with Boeing as a major defense contractor and supplier of arms to Israel. Now, the students have not been out there doing property damage at the Boeing facility at Gresham. And of course, they make commercial planes here, but it's the larger Boeing entity the students are protesting. But would this be an area where you might look differently at actions that were actually part of the previous anti-war movements, where actions here in Portland, there was a plan to bomb the ROTC building. And one of the faculty members in the philosophy department at Portland State served some time in prison around that allegations of his participation in that. So I think people understood then that the ROTC and campus recruiting was directly related to the Vietnam War.
Yeah, I think that's a different category altogether of property damage. You have that in the anti-war movement. You have that in also the present-day environmental movement, you know.
Yeah, but one of the costs of some of those tactics in the anti-war movement, including the Weather Underground, that use this line, bring the war back home, blowing up buildings, very careful to protect human life in those actions. But it alienated a lot of people. People do not want to bring their children, or families to events that have that kind of violence and to participate in it in ways that put a lot of people in risk, particularly those that are more vulnerable to the criminal justice system.
Yeah, that's true. You know, in general, I think the test any tactic needs to pass is first of all, is it going to grow the movement? Second of all, is there a cause effect connection between the action you're taking and the liberation of Palestine? And I really can't think of any form of property damage in our midst, in practical terms, here in the United States, that would in any way materially contribute to that aim.
You've been referring to a number of historical moments and particularly around tactics and ways of thinking about direct action as they communicate the aims and the purpose of a movement. In closing, are there other historical lessons you think are important to draw on?
Well, I think absolutely. This is what makes all of these movements so challenging. If I contrast them, for example, with the labor movement. The labor movement, if you're a labor activist and you come up in it, there's a continuity that generally you know what the options are. There's business unionism, there's organizing for collective bargaining inside the box. There is social movement unionism, class struggle unionism, and there is an awareness of the history behind each one of those tactics. And that history is passed on. When it comes to all other social movements, including this emerging one in support of the Palestinian people, we don't have that institutionalized memory, and we don't have the continuity of schools where you come up in there and you know what the tactics are. So the only other alternative we have is we have to sit back and study what has been successful in other times and other places by people who were trying to build people power to take on economic might or military might. And I don't see any other way around it, but at a great disadvantage compared to the movement of labor.
This movement now that has emerged, and it's not clear how far back to trace its history. It has a long history, even among student groups. I'm not sure how much of that has been transmitted, the Palestinian rights movement through student groups. But one of the lessons of history that you seem to be citing here is the connections between students and labor. All back in 68 and earlier periods, the anti-apartheid movement around South Africa, it seems that a critical part of movements has been alliances between student activists, student radicals, and more left-wing labor union members and activists. And that seems to be happening now with the International Longshore Workers Union, the Auto Workers Union. Can you speak to that as a labor activist locally, as well?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think the logic of what makes labor movement strong and the logic of, say, the BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and in the Palestinian Liberation Movement is the same logic. You build power in order to withdraw something of economic value. Workers withdraw their labor in mass numbers in order to move the employer class. Martin Luther King spoke about this really clearly in terms of the lessons that the civil rights movement. They said everything we did when it came to the boycotts, we learned from labor. It's the same principle. And then it requires organization and coordinated action. So in mass numbers, your withdrawal of economic support can weaken the powers that you want to influence. So there is learning between the civil rights movement and the labor movement that happened in the past, and I think boycott, divestment, and sanctions follows the same principle.
Well, thank you so much, Jose Padin, for joining us today as a scholar and also a longtime activist, racial justice and labor activist. So I hope you come on the show again on the Old Mole to reflect on where we're at. And it's both hopeful but worrisome times ahead.
Thank you, Jen, for having me here and having this conversation. I hope it has some spin-offs in the community. These are things that need to be explored continuously by everyone who wants to be active.
Thanks so much, Jose Padin, for being with us today.
الفروق بينا حدود كلام على الورق مكتوب والمكتوب أصبح قيود تمنعنا نشوف
قتلونا وهجروني وصار الحجر بيدي سلاحي مثل الدم أبيض وأسود جوفيتي هزر نجاحي وبكفي كفاني شايل بكفي كر اللي جاي.
That was a little more music from Rajin. Before that, Jen Hockum was speaking with Jose Padin about winning tactics for social justice movements. I'm Patricia Kohlberg with the Old Mole Variety Hour. We're only on the air because alternative radio continues to thrive in Portland because of the generous support of listeners like you. If you can, please donate to keep KBOO going. Better yet, become a monthly sustainer. You can donate by texting KBOO to 44321 or clicking on the red donate button on your KBOO app. Or you can go to bit.ly/KBOO. You can also send a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. Who knows if the big earthquake of the Cascadia subduction zone will happen in our lifetime or the lifetime of our kids or grandkids. But if it does, Portland is woefully unprepared, particularly in regards to the critical energy infrastructure hub known as the Tank Farm. Enough fuels are stored just south of Linton on seismically unstable land that the explosions, fires, landslides, toxic fumes, and spills unleashed by an earthquake would make the Deep Horizon disaster look like a glass of spilled milk. The scope of this problem has been known for years. Why can't we fix it? The short answer is that our laws and regulations privilege corporate interests over community safety. But a broad coalition of community groups has come together to challenge those interests. On April 16, a press conference was held to present an open letter from 75 community-based organizations to state officials and legislators demanding action. Today, we air a recording of that press conference, which features Michael Ponsel from the Portland Harbor Community Advisory Group, Nancy Heiser from the Linton Neighborhood Association, Chris Voss, Director of Emergency Management at Multnomah County, yours truly from Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and Jay Wilson, former chair of the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission. The first speaker you hear is moderator Nikki Mandel, member of the CEI Hub Task Force and Climate Jobs.
Our group of volunteers is dedicated to raising awareness, public awareness, of the human, environmental, and economic risks posed by the critical energy infrastructure hub. That 6-mile-long stretch of bulk fuel storage tanks that squeeze between Highway 30 and the Willamette River, just below the northern reaches of Forest Park. Many people have been working on CEI hub issues for years, some since the mid-1990s, when seismologists and later other scientists began to understand the risks posed by storing toxic fuels and other chemicals in what came to be understood as a highly dangerous seismic zone because they're located on liquefiable soil. With the added danger of it also being located at a wildlife-urban interface zone subject to the kinds of fires that we're all too well aware of. Yet too little has been done to prevent or mitigate a situation that could turn into a cataclysmic disaster at any moment. So a year ago, our task force began a concerted campaign to increase public awareness of the dangers associated with the CEI hub. Our goal is to build a constituency large enough and engaged enough to compel public officials, local, state, and federal, to work in a concerted way with the urgency the situation demands, to develop and implement long overdue risk mitigation and prevention policies for the CEI hub. Toward this end, we talked with scores of neighborhood associations, community organizations, and faith-based groups. In addition to sharing information on the CEI hub drawn from government reports and research studies, we invited each group to sign a joint letter to public officials demanding 6 specific actions. More than 80 separate organizations, including 48 neighborhood associations, signed the letter. Today, we're announcing that we have sent that letter, signed by 85 organizations, to Governor Kotek, DEQ Director Felden, members of the Portland City Council, the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners, Metro Council, state legislators, House and Senate, and Oregon's federal delegation. The letter reminds these officials that we are all just one earthquake, one train derailment, one human error away from tragedy. It highlights 6 specific areas in need of their concerted, coordinated action. Public education to ensure that area residents are aware of CEI hub-related dangers and emergency procedures. 2, monitoring and remediation of pollution at the CEI hub. 3, a new plan for Oregon's fuel storage that is grounded in a commitment to environmental justice and full community participation. Fourth, a mechanism to hold CEI Hub companies, not taxpayers, responsible for the full costs of any disaster. Fifth, a system to keep local officials and emergency responders up to date on the fuels and chemicals that are being stored and transported to and from the hub. Sixth, monitoring Zenith Energy's operations to ensure full compliance with their contractual promises to the city and state, including promises about the safety of biofuels. These six actions are not random. They reflect recommendations made by concerned residents, recommendations in state and local government reports, and what we learned in conversations with professionals in seismology, geology, risk management, and emergency service. And we're honored today to have five of those experts with us to highlight the urgency of the issues raised in this letter to public officials. So first, I'm really honored to introduce Michael Pouncell, member of the City of Portland Planning Commission and Executive Director of the Portland Harbor Community Advisory Group.
Okay, thanks everyone. Just to clarify that I am not here representing the Planning Commission, but my community and the Portland Harbor Community Advisory Group. Portland and Oregon leaders need to make space. They need to deeply and actively listen. North Portland is experiencing slow violence of a toxic geography that is the critical energy infrastructure hub, what we call the CEI hub. We are making a call for everyone to be aware of the CEI hub seismic risk analysis. This was funded by the City of Portland, Multnomah County. The geography in North Portland poses serious health, safety, cultural, social justice, economic, and environmental risk. Every Portland neighborhood and the region will be impacted. I live near the CEI hub. If there is a seismic event, a train derailment, a forest fire that impacted the CEI hub, it would be an existential disaster for my neighbors. Folks in Linton, St. John, University Park, Portsmouth, the whole peninsula will most likely be dead or severely impacted by massive explosions, toxic vapor, or the lack of emergency services and rescue. We implore you to investigate and look at Multnomah County and the City of Portland's data by Googling impact the fuel release from CEI Hub. The data will explain very complicated substance toxicities of VOCs and PAHs. VOCs disperse in the air and are toxic when inhaled, impacting residents, first responders working on the spill, and air-breathing mammals in the marine environment. PAHs persist long after the spills. Studies in Alaska and Washington suggest that PAHs are harmful to fish eggs and embryos. We need action now. We need more daylight on the CEI hub. This slow violence from the CEI hub's toxic geography may seem out of sight for now, but all of Portland will suffer from its negative impacts. We need more leadership, education, preparation from companies, and frequent updates for local first responders on their toxic hazards that are stored on their site. We are asking for leaders to do more than just account and mitigate the potential damages. We want monitoring of tankers and transport of chemicals and oils. We want new plans for fuel storage. We want more media awareness and education of CI Hub's toxic geography. We do not want an East Palestine, Ohio, 100,000 gallons of chemicals spilled. We do not want a Mosier, Washington, 47,000 gallons of oil spilled. We do not want a Lac Megantic in Canada, 1.6 million gallons of oil spilled. We do not want a Custer, Washington, 29.9 thousand gallons of oil spilled.
Thank you, Michael. Now I want to introduce Nancy Heiser, a community safety advocate, member of Linton Neighborhood Association, and the Linton Neighborhood Emergency Team.
Good morning. I'm Nancy Heiser, and I live in Linton, home to the CEI Hub. When you look at the dangers of the CEI Hub, it's not hard to understand. You can credit many reports making it clear, and having once seen, you can't go back. The Cascadia subduction zone was recognized as a still active fault in the early 90s. Substantive reports of the seismic dangers of the hub began in 2012. Some of the people that wrote those reports are in this room. Multnomah County published a comprehensive report in 2022, and recently, their very sobering report revealed more: deadly gas releases during a seismic event. Despite this substantial evidence and years of advocacy by the public, we are no safer now than we were 30 years ago. It's clear disaster triggers aren't limited to earthquakes, and we have two: the Cascadia offshore and the Portland Hills fault underneath the hub. Lightning strikes are the main cause of oil tank fires and explosions worldwide. Floods occur with increasing frequency, and the hub is in a floodplain on liquefiable soil. Accidents have been alluded to, like the Ohio train derailment happened. Human error is always a possibility. The list goes on. It's a ticking time bomb. Living in Linton, we fear for our lives and the catastrophic effects on the city, the state, and beyond. And we witness the ongoing poisoning of air, water, and land on a regular basis. Toxins released by tanks, trains, and trucks spread in air plumes to other areas, causing chronic health problems and cancer. The Willamette River is toxic for humans and wildlife, and that poisoned water flows all the way to the Pacific Ocean. Chemicals leak into the soil undetected from tanks that are old and built to no standards. Legislation is often passed after an incident. Given the predicted scope and magnitude of a CEI hub catastrophe, the loss of human life, environmental destruction, and billions of dollars of cleanup, prevention is critical. Officials must do more. Big Oil reported record profits to stockholders in 2022, $219 billion. How much did they invest in reducing the dangers? Why aren't facilities held accountable for the risks they present? Why is industry given permits that compromise communities' health and safety? Why isn't government oversight adequate to protect us? Last year, I served on the Rules Advisory Committee for DEQ. The state's first ever oversight, progress was made, but the program's limited scope will take up to another 9 years to make the hub structurally safer. There are critical issues right now that need all levels of government working together. Our city officials, those with land use jurisdiction, have disregarded community concerns and advanced an agenda that prioritized and supported corporations. Moving ahead beyond Zenith, we need to turn a corner. Will the new officials prioritize community rights for safety and health over corporate profits? Can we stop sacrificing the environment? For decades now, experts have revealed this reality that demands public awareness and action. Yet we meet local people every day that aren't aware of the risks. So our work is to help the public understand and call for officials to act at all levels. I'm grateful to be in community with all of you today. Thank you.
We're taking a break from the press conference to remind you that you are listening to KBOO Portland, and we need your support. KBOO is an alternative, non-commercial radio station which depends on listener support. Help us reach our goal of $60,000 by texting KBOO to 44321 or clicking on the red donate button on your KBOO app, or you can go to bit.ly/KBOO. Now, back to the conclusion of the CEI Hub press conference.
Next, we'll hear from Chris Voss, Director of the Multnomah County Office of Emergency Management.
Great. First off, I'm really glad to be here, and I'm even more grateful that everybody else is here, and thank you all for standing up behind me. I will try to keep this short for some of these folks, but I wanted to say a couple things first that I think are really, really important. And I heard from one of my peers talk about a lot of the other emergencies that have happened, a lot of the other spills that have happened, and we don't want to be like one of those other cities. We did a report a few years ago that talked specifically about the CEI Hub after a Cascadia event that indicated that the spill after a Cascadia event would be somewhere around between 95 million and 194 million gallons of oil. Exxon Valdez was 11 million gallons, to put that in perspective. So I agree with my counterpart, but I also want to say that if Cascadia were to happen tomorrow, being like one of those cities might be a best-case scenario for us because of the risk that we have. And that's why I think we're all here today. There are three things that I very much believe that we need to do. And it's been said by some of my other counterparts, but I want to address some of these things. Yes, the CEI Hub was built before we truly understood the earthquake risk. And they built tanks that are susceptible to both liquefaction and lateral spread, in some areas, 12 feet of ground movement. Really very, very significant. But now that we know and understand that risk, the three things that we need to do are, one, we need to improve the tanks that are there now. We need to improve their safety. Number two, we need to stop putting tanks and hazardous materials on our worst soils. And I want to say this because I think that some people misunderstand that a little bit. They're not bad soils. They're our worst soils. We've managed to hit the bullseye there. And now that we know and understand the risk, we've got to change that. And then the third thing we have to do is make sure that the organizations that are storing and continue to store hazardous materials in and around Multnomah County, that they're held accountable. We've talked a lot about risk bonding to make sure that they are have the adequate amount of insurance in place. And before this event, I talked a lot about the Act of God clause that exists in everything from the oil Prevention Act to many other rules that sometimes let these organizations off the hook after a major disaster. But I will tell you, we've known now about Cascadia and a lot of these other hazards for decades. So it's not an unknown. We know it's a when and not an if. And so we need to make sure that they have the tools in place to compensate if there is, in fact, an event. But hopefully, with my step one and two, that never happens. That's got to be our first approach. But even with all of that, I suspect that there still could be an incident, and that's why we want to make sure that they have the tools in place to make sure to reimburse the county and the people of Multnomah County for any incident that would occur. Let's stop the event to the extent that we can, but let's make sure that those organizations are accountable. I want to thank you again for being here, and I'll talk it up to the next speaker.
Thank you, Chris. I'm happy to introduce now Patricia Kohlberg, MD, MPH, Medical Director of Multnomah County for 20 years from 1988 to 2008. Thank you.
Good morning. From a public health perspective, I think there are a few things worth knowing about the CEI Hub. Dozens and dozens of hazardous chemicals are emitted on a daily basis at the CEI Hub as part of normal operations. These chemicals cause a broad range of harm to public health, and the fact that the companies there actually meet air quality standards does not mean that the public health is adequately protected. These chemicals include neurotoxins like lead and mercury, substances that impair cardiovascular function like nitrogen oxides and particulate matter, forever chemicals like PCBs and dioxins that cause cancer and poor pregnancy outcomes, volatile organic compounds like benzene, which cause cancer, and much, much more. Particulate matter is particularly worrisome. These are really tiny particles that are composed of a broad array of toxic substances that are breathed very deeply into the lungs, and they are the chief component of diesel exhaust, which is estimated to cause every year worldwide 20% of all deaths, primarily through cardiovascular disease. These particulates are emitted from the pipes and valves and tanks at the hub, but the biggest emissions might be from the trucks and trains and barges that come and go from the hub and sit there idling for hours on end. These tailpipe emissions, however, are not monitored as part of the normal operations and are unregulated, so we don't know exactly how much is being emitted. But furthermore, this traffic, trains, trucks, and barges, pass through north and northeast communities of Portland, of communities of color and immigrant and low-income communities, where people are dying on average about 5 to 10 years earlier than people who live in other parts of the city. There are other problems with the regulatory apparatus. The EPA standards, for example, for safe level of exposure are pegged for the adult healthy male, which means that the most vulnerable among us, women, pregnant people, the very old, the very young, people with chronic disease, are the least protected. The standards assume that people are exposed to only one toxin at a time, which never happens, and ignores the cumulative effect of simultaneous exposure. And some toxins have no safe level of exposure, including particulate matter. Companies are mostly required not to actually measure their emissions, but what they do instead is they take the volume of the fuels that are being passed through their facility and plug them into a formula to estimate their toxic emissions. The formula in question, the AP42, it has been challenged in academic papers and in the courts, and very often found not to adequately represent what is actually being emitted. Also, the companies are regulated as separate entities without taking into account the buildup of airborne toxics, which is surely happening in a space with so many polluters in such a tiny space. So in summary, Portland hosts a very toxic brew of chemicals that is being emitted into the already polluted air of Portland, and these can cause a large array of harms to public health, and the regulatory apparatus is not protective, and especially not for those most vulnerable. Thank you. Our last speaker, and we're very honored to have, as we are with all the speakers, will be Jay Wilson, past chair of the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission from 2014 to 2017.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you to our host here at Augustina Lutheran Church and to all the neighborhoods who have a show of force here today. My name is Jay Wilson, and although I work as an emergency manager in Clackamas County, I'm not representing the county, but I'm speaking from the informed position I held as the past chair from 2014 to 2017 of the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission, OSPAC, in the years after the release of the Oregon Resilience Plan in 2013. I'm honored to be a part of this discussion on the Oregon CEI Hub, since the location and setting creates a concentration of extreme risk to lives and livelihoods. You've heard compelling statements today about how truly terrible this place will be when the big earthquake happens, and I would like to provide some suggested direction. The support letter has a broad point that we need a new plan for Oregon's fuel storage that is grounded in a commitment to environmental justice and full community participation. My ask is that the state of Oregon needs a 2050 vision for a well-managed, just transition of the CEI hub and a mindful approach to how all of this current risk should not be borne by our children and grandchildren as the clock continues to tick since Oregon's last great magnitude 9 earthquake in 1700. The potential for the worst oil spill in U.S. history is something that we ourselves have inherited from the community planners and energy developers over the last 100 years. Our understanding of the earthquake and the oil risk is now on our watch, and we cannot kick this can down the road. This 2050 vision needs to frame the CEI hub function as an essential measuring point for Oregon's climate change strategy in reducing greenhouse gas emissions and our overall carbon footprint. Right now, the long-term transition from the CEI hub's oil storage capacity is not included in the Oregon Global Warming Commission's 2035 and 2050 plans. Shouldn't the volume of over 350 million gallons of daily petroleum storage that we currently use and need be something we measure as an indicator of meeting our long-term climate goals? Will we need to maintain the same oil storage capacity for the next 26 years? In the coming months, there are two critical milestones of the 2022 Senate Bill 1567 legislation we need to be aware of: the Department of Environmental Quality's evaluation of CEI Hub seismic risk assessments, and the Oregon Department of Energy's State Energy Security Plan. On June 1st, the CEI Hub oil storage facilities must submit their seismic vulnerability assessments to the DEQ, Fuel Tank Seismic Stability Program, that include assessments for geotechnical, structural, and safety elements. Once DEQ reviews and approves these assessments, then the facility owners have 180 days to submit risk mitigation plans with 10 years to full implementation. This DEQ review and approval is critical for what degree of seismic code enforcement these companies will need to demonstrate. On September 30th, the Department of Energy will submit the very first Oregon Energy Security Plan to the legislature, with specific requirements from Senate Bill 1567 to address the Cascadia earthquake's impacts to energy facilities and recommendations for the geographical diversification of oil storage facilities. For energy security, we need to ask the Department of Energy and the legislature, why should we continue to concentrate over 90% of the petroleum storage facilities for the entire state along the lower Willamette River in Portland and adjacent to so many impacted neighborhoods? Yeah. For the Department of Environmental Quality, we need to ask, why should the oil companies double down and harden in place their seismically deficient tanks in one of the worst locations possible in Oregon to store oil? facing liquefaction and earthquake fault neighborhoods, oil spills, toxic plumes, landslides, and wildfire. Where is the 2050 vision? I see these huge challenges as an opportunity to a pivot point right now to align and leverage our seismic risks to reach and supplement our climate change goals, our energy security planning, and our need to address environmental justice. There are very real win-wins in the policy alignments of all these critical issues if we can only craft an inclusive, unifying 2050 policy vision to harness what must be done. Please consider all of your individual and collective roles in reducing the CEI Hub's risk by helping to frame the future direction and decisions needed for the improved public safety, environmental protection, and energy security. Our collective public will can and should set the platform expectation for our elected and community leaders. We cannot stop the earthquake, but we can minimize or prevent the potential CEI Hub oil catastrophe while charting a more holistic path forward. Thank you.
You just heard a recording from the April 16 press conference about the critical need to address the disaster in waiting at Portland's tank farm. That's it for our show today. I want to thank Jan Hocken and her guest, Jose Padin. A big shout out to the 75 organizations and hundreds of activists that came together to demand action at the CEI Hub. And as always, a thanks to the hardworking KBOO staff. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the hour. Before I sign off, I want to remind you how lucky Portland has been this past half century to have a thriving alternative radio station where our diverse communities can find their voice. Please help to keep KBOO on the air. You can donate by texting KBOO to 44321 or clicking on the red donate button on your KBOO app, or you can go to bit.ly/KBOO. ليس لنا عون سوى أرسل لنا ربي حنا. I'm going to leave you with more from that song, Raji'in. Join us again next Monday morning. Until then, stay safe and stay active. رجع تاني على ارضي الاقصى صلي فيه فردي جايه معاكو الطيران انا زميلي جايه معاكو ارضي افداي 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 انا مش ماشي انا في مكاني على خط النار كل ليل ونار ولو هموت في ايدي سلاحي حد ما يجي النسيم ورا ازاي نجيب احنا في صف العزيز سامحنا يا رحيم اننا عاجزين عمره ما كان تطبيع شوفنا السفاحين تقتل طفل بريء في دمه بتستبيح زيفوا التاريخ بدموع التماثيل تلقاتي للاطفال صنايعي الاهوال كاذبي الاقوال سارقي لا مال اطفال ضدنا انا عايشين بلدنا ومنا ما ماشيين ما رضنا وفيها بس نوعين عزال بدون سلاح لكن معانا رب العالمين رب العالمين